Before we begin, I want to thank everyone for their prayers and support during this last week with the death of my father. Some of you I've talked with, but we had such a nice visit with him on Thursday evening of last week, and it was a good time of me reading to him from the Bible and praying with him, and we were able to work through some things that that were on his heart, and it was a great time. It was something I didn't think that I was going to have, and I just felt that God really gave me an opportunity just to be there with him and talk to him. So I just want to appreciate your prayers. I know a lot of you all were praying for him and for me, and I really appreciated that because it made a big difference. Open your Bibles to Daniel 3. I was thinking there as Rod was talking about some of the issues that we're facing in our country today and the seeming sickness of our leaders. Say that sickness isn't necessarily only in the political realm, but exists in the Christian realm, church realm as well. But there seems to be a pervasive ignorance and stupidity that reigns today, something that I didn't think I would ever live to see. And, I've watched and been focused on politics since back when Nixon was in office and the whole Watergate scandal. I can remember being very focused on that. Politics was a big thing in our family. We would often have some interesting discussions and arguments about politics. It was always a topic of discussion. I remember the first time that I took Kathy to West Virginia, I noticed that the roads were freshly paved. And in West Virginia, they always paved the roads on election year to ensure that they received a vote, because roads were a big issue where I grew up in West Virginia. Because of the coal trucks, the roads were always full of potholes. So every election year, prior to the election, they would repave the roads. And Kathy asked me, she said, "How do you know it's election year? What difference does it make with the paving the roads?" I said, "It always happens." And sure enough, there you go. We were in election year. Before we begin reading, though, I want to share a short story with you. In AD 320, there were 40 Christian soldiers of the Roman 12th Legion who had received an edict that all soldiers were to offer a sacrifice to the pagan gods. This was done to make sure that these men were allied with the emperor. This was a time when the Roman Empire was in decline. It was beginning to fall apart. And so the emperor wanted to make sure that all of the soldiers were loyal to him. So when they received the order, these particular soldiers replied, "You can have our armor, even our bodies, but our heart's allegiance belongs to Jesus Christ." It happened to be midwinter, and so their captain decided that the way that he would get them to bow to his will is he would march them onto a frozen lake and give them an ultimatum. "You can either die or you can renounce Christ." And so he forced them to remove their clothes, and through the night, these men huddled together to stay warm, but one by one, the temperature began to take them, and they fell to the ice and died. And finally, there was one man left, and he looked at all of the other soldiers lying around him, frozen to death, and he couldn't take it anymore. And he crawled over to the shore and said, "I renounce Christ." But there was one man who was watching. He was the captain of the guard who was in charge, and he had been watching these soldiers dying one by one. And when he saw this man break ranks, he walked out onto the ice and he said, "I too am a Christian." You see, he had been one secretly for fear. And so he stripped off his clothes and he too died on the ice. And so when the sun came up that morning, there were 40 soldiers who had fought for the death for Christ. And as I read that story, and when we hear stories like that, we marvel at the courage and we think, yeah, we could be like that. That's me. I would probably do the same thing. But when we think about that, we have to realize that we might run for the shore. There is no guarantee that we would stand there and say, yes, I'll freeze for Christ. I'll stay there. And so we have to think about where we're going to be when that moment comes for us. And oftentimes, sad to say, Christians will break because somebody makes fun of them. They're not out on the ice, they're not freezing to death, they're not under a death penalty. They're simply being made fun of, and they will shut their mouth and they'll cower down and they'll pretend that Christ doesn't exist. So we have to think about that as we read this story. And before we begin reading, let's bow our heads and let's ask God to open our hearts and really speak to us through his word. Our Father, this is a great topic and so relevant to our time in which we live. All around us, we see the pressures to bow to the political forces, to bow to the culture. Each of us are making decisions every day about what we will say, about what we'll do. And I pray, Father, that you'll open our hearts, make this so relevant, make it so real. May this not just be an exercise in, well, we read this, we learned something, and out the door we go and to our fried chicken and mashed potatoes. But Lord, may this be a true working of our hearts as you cleanse us, as you look at us and examine us and teach us and strengthen us so that we will be like these men, ones who will resist unto the death. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, let's take a look at Daniel 3. We're going to read 1 through 18. I'm going to break this up into two parts, this chapter. It's a little too long to try to do in one Sunday, and we'll do our best to get through this. So follow along with me there. King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue, 90 feet high, 9 feet wide, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Scholars estimate that this was around 7 to 10 miles south of the present city of what would at that time have been the city of Babylon in Iraq on that plain. So King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the advisors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to attend the dedication of the statue. And so the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the advisors, and the treasurers, and the judges, and the magistrates, and all the rulers of the province assembled for the dedication of the statue the king had set up. And then they stood before the statue Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So here they all are. They're all assembled. They're sitting around. And now the time has come for them to stand. So they all stand up. They all get ready. They're all standing there. And then a herald proudly proclaims, or loudly proclaims this. He says, "People of every nation." There's something important here that you need to remember. As we're reading this, there are specifics in this passage that are going to have a great deal to do with why they're doing what they're doing. And it has a lot to do with the turmoil that's in our nation today. Because in our nation today, we have gone so far to a road of nothing is important, nothing that has been done before is sacred, everything is relative, and everybody just get along and everybody be who they are. And the shame about that is that it is affecting our country in such a way that it's making us question who we are as a people. And anyone who stands for the red, white, and blue, and apple pie, and baseball is looked at with suspicion, as if they are odd or weird for some reason. And so we're in a period of time now where we're on a pinnacle, and we're teetering back and forth. It's not over, it's not lost, but we're teetering. And Christians in particular have the opportunity this fall to help to influence this thing And they have the opportunity every day in front of them to influence this tipping that we're going through. And so it's very important that Christians wake up, be involved, speak out, and stand up. Because if we don't, I can guarantee you the other side will. And what they will do is they will very quickly squish us like a bug. And it's not because we're worried about who we are. It's because we're worried about the future generations. And we're worried about what this country was established to do, which is spread the gospel. All right, so look again with me. So this herald loudly proclaims, and he says this, "People of every nation and language, you are commanded." I love that, don't you? Our president did this very thing this week, didn't he? Didn't you hear him do that? "I command you. I proclaim. I. And you see, the ideas of Satan, those ideas are not new. You see, he has no new tricks. He just uses the same ones. And people are so stupid that they fall for them. Christians do. We all do. And if you look at the things that are going on in our country, and if you look at this particular book, you will find parallels between the two, and it will help you to know how to act. You see, that's why the scriptures are so important, is because they teach you. Paul said, "It is our schoolmaster to teach us." They teach you how to react, how we must be. As I said, how you should be of all men, of all women, how you should react. The scriptures teach us. So again, look at it. He says, when you hear the sound, listen to what he says. When you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the drum, and every kind of music, you're to fall down and worship the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. Therefore, look at what happens when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, and every kind of music. People of every nation and language fell down and they worshiped the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. But some Chaldeans took this occasion to come forward, and they maliciously accused the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. You as king have issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the drum, and every kind of music must fall down and worship the gold statue. And whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. There are some Jews who have been appointed to manage the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men have ignored you, the king. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up." Then in a furious rage, Nebuchadnezzar gave orders to bring in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar asked them, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true that you don't serve my gods or worship the gold statue I've set up? Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the drum, and every kind of music, fall down and worship the statue I made. But if you don't worship it, you will immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. And who is the God who can rescue you from my power?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer to this question. If the God we serve exists, then he can rescue us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he can rescue us from the power of you, the king. But even if he does not rescue us, we want you as king to know that we will not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you set up." So in reading this particular passage, we often wonder, where is Daniel? Why isn't he in this story? Is he one of the group of people who's bowing down? Where is he? But you have to understand that about 20 years have gone by since Daniel interpreted the king's dream. And he was either too high in the government. Remember, he was in the palace. All these other men were working within the government, but he was reserved for the palace. Or else he was off on business on the day of the dedication. But you see, the king didn't need to question his allegiance because the king had had ample opportunity during those intervening 20 years to observe Daniel's unwavering commitment to him. They had an extremely close working relationship. almost as close as a father-son relationship. They were almost friends, these two. But look what happens here with the statue. If you think about this statue being erected, it's probably made of wood, and it's probably overlaid with gold, because a statue of this size would require exactly 8,262,806 and some odd ounces of gold. That was more gold than it was in the entire kingdom. And so it was most likely a statue or a column that was made out of gold or wood and then overlaid with a sheet of gold. The Greek historian Herodotus, writing after Nebuchadnezzar's time, noted that in one of the temples there was a statue that was 18 feet tall, made of solid gold. King Xerxes of the Persians removed that statue after much effort and took it back to Persia. But this statue that we're talking about here is most likely not made out of solid gold. And I want you to think about something else. A lot of scholars have speculated that this wasn't necessarily a statue of a man or a statue of a figure, because it's totally out of proportion to the proportion of a man. It's actually a proportion of 10 to 1. And so there was most likely a stela or a column, and then on top of that was most likely a statue. And if you think about this particular statue, it's of the same proportions of 10 to 1 as the Washington Monument. Isn't that amazing? And it may very well have been something similar to the Washington Monument. And for those of you who are into numbers and conspiracy theories, I want you to think about this for just a moment. The Washington Monument, base of the Washington Monument, is exactly 666 inches per side. The height of it is 6,666 inches. So you can do with that as you will. I was on a website this morning where they were describing the Washington Monument as part of the Satanic Kingdom. It may very well be. But the proportions of 10 to 1 work out, and they work out exactly to this measurement. There are some who have speculated that the 90 feet tall by the 9 feet wide that this statue or this column that Nebuchadnezzar put up also is divisible by 6, and that you can also get the numeral 666 out of it in some way. Some people believe that it may have been a column copied after one of the ones which the Washington Monument is from one of the ones in Egypt, because you remember Nebuchadnezzar had gone into Egypt, captured Egypt, and he may have been heavily influenced by the architecture of Egypt. And so he decided this was a fitting monument to himself. And others have speculated it may have been a statue of the fire god Bel Marduk, and hence the punishment of burning for those who refuse to worship it. Others have speculated that perhaps on top of this column there may have been a statue of Nebuchadnezzar himself. Remember, Daniel predicted that he was the head of gold. He may have decided, I'm going to go beyond that. I'm going to be more than a head of gold. I'll be a statue of gold. I'll be the full figure. I will show everyone that I'm more than just a head of gold. I'll be a figure. And two accounts seem to come from this, and a desire on the part of the king, which is principally to be worshipped. You see, we all want to be worshipped, don't we? Husbands, we look at our wives and we glory in them worshiping us, don't we? Don't we? Really, seriously, don't we? Sure we do. We want them to think we're the greatest thing since sliced bread. Sure we do. We want them to think that we are the hunk. And that's what King Nebuchadnezzar wanted everyone to do, is he wanted them to worship him. And you have to remember by this time that Nebuchadnezzar is reaching a very pinnacle point in his life, a point that many of us here have reached, and that is middle age. And he's at that crunch time where he begins to look at his life and he begins to realize that he has less time in front of him than he does behind him. He's at that middle age period. And there's something that happens with a man. I don't know if it particularly happens with women in the same way, but something begins to happen to a man, and he begins to think of his legacy. He begins to think about what he's leaving behind. And in his paranoia, the king may have wanted to eliminate any potential rivals, because you remember when Daniel did his prediction of what would come in the future, he told him, one day there will be kingdoms that will follow you. And so as he's becoming more paranoid and more concerned about being middle-aged, he's probably concerned that he wants to make sure there are no rivals in his kingdom. If you can imagine the thought that anyone would come after him and inherit this beautiful city of Babylon that he has built, it was probably more than he could bear. You know, at my house, I have the old bridge that used to go across the Rappahannock River. And it's cut into sections and lengths of iron. And my family asked me sometimes, they said, why don't you sell that? Think of what we could do with that money. And I said, well, why would I do that? I want to leave it for you to use. And they look at me and they say, Dad, we don't necessarily want it. And I said, well, that's my legacy to you. That's my monument. So Nebuchadnezzar wanted a monument of gold. I want a monument of iron. Okay. So the second reason that he was doing this was probably to ensure his political and social stability. Do you remember something occurred, and something that I shared with you at the very outset of these verses? And that was, there were so many different people groups in this kingdom, so many different languages, that he wanted to make sure that his kingdom was stable. And you see, if you recall back in the 90s, there was a breakup of a country named Yugoslavia after the death of the man who ruled that country as dictator named Marshal Tito. And the country literally split apart along ethnic groups. And if you can remember that period, if you were alive at that time or following what was going on over there, the brutality of that period as these ethnic groups fought each other was equivalent to what happened in the Holocaust. A bloody, brutal period of time as these people fought over who was going to inherit the different sections of the country. And so to ensure that these ethnic differences don't lead into revolt, Nebuchadnezzar is going to create stability. Notice in verse 2 and 3 what happens here. There's a representative from every level of government, every language, every people group is represented by someone who is a leader in that group. The first group is the satraps, and these are the highest officials in each province. If you could imagine board of supervisors from every county. That's what kind of people we're talking about here. There were also the prefects, or the military leaders, the governors who administered the various sections of the provinces. So here you have all of the governors. That's why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are there. You remember, they were made governors. That's why they're there. And so you have these people. You have also the advisors who interpret the laws. These are the attorneys. These are the judges. Treasurers, magistrates who enforce the law. Petty rulers who were the general bureaucrats. These are the town council people. There was a representative from every group who was in this meeting or this dedication to ensure that there was total allegiance. Now, the question that would arise in this section is, why did he use music? Now, there's something unique about music, if you haven't realized this, especially if you're a father or a mother of teenagers, you probably realize this. And that is that the music that your teens like most likely is not the one that you like. And there's often conflict that occurs because of that dynamic. All of you younger people are grinning about this because you understand what I'm talking about. So there's that conflict that happens. But there's also something very interesting about music, and that is, if it's a certain kind of music, it will draw people together. You see, there's nothing like music to pull people together. For those of you who have studied the period of World War II and Nazi Germany, one of the things that Hitler said about Nazi Germany was there would have been no Nazi Germany had it not been for the opera of Wagner. There would have been no Nazi party because he used the music from the opera. He used the pageantry to pull people together. And again, as I said earlier, there is no new trick. It's all the same thing. And so one of the things that he's using here is he's using this music to pull these people together. Some people have speculated that perhaps this was the national anthem of Babylon that was being played here. So Nebuchadnezzar knew that if, in order to have the allegiance of all these people, he must begin with these people of state. But there's also a hidden fear. Now look at the passage for just a minute. There's a hidden fear that could be easily missed. You remember in the dream, the last kingdoms that were mentioned in the dream is kingdoms of clay and kingdoms of iron. And you remember what Daniel said to him? He said, those kingdoms will be unstable because they will be composed of what? Different people, different languages, different cultures. And so as he's been thinking about this for the last 20 years, he's realized that his kingdom is composed of what? Different people, different languages, different cultures. And the last thing that Nebuchadnezzar wants is for his kingdom to begin to crumble. He doesn't want to see it begin to fall apart. And if you'll recall from a few years ago, about 10, 15 years ago, there was a huge movement in this country called multiculturalism. You remember that? The problems that we're experiencing today in our country are largely the result of that period of time. Because the thing that was pressed at that time in the public schools and in the public arena was multiculturalism. Everyone is equal. All cultures are equal. All thoughts are equal. And therefore, we must glorify anyone who has an opposing theory than yours, no matter how obscure or how off it is. And so now we're reaping the results of that, or the benefits of a multicultural environment and teaching system. And that is that everything that is held to be sacred or nationalistic is being questioned and being cast aside in the voice and effort and respect for multiculturalism. And that is why that type of idea, that type of mindset is so dangerous. Because with our country, now listen to me, with our country, with all of its problems, is composed of peoples from all parts of the world who brought their problems with them. And when they came to this country, because of the design of this country, because this country was founded upon this book, because of that, we were able to take all of the problems that we brought with us and begin to get rid of them, as long as we followed the tenets of this book. And it's when we are beginning moving away from it that we begin to see those problems resurfacing again. And the divisions begin to come up. All right. So notice again in verse 7, these different nationalities and languages. Nebuchadnezzar very easily could have feared that there would be disunity. And so that prompted the ceremony of allegiance. Look particularly at verse 6, and you'll see that he's given people a compelling incentive to do as he says. If you do this, you'll live. If you don't do it, you'll do what? You'll die. And the death that he's giving them is barbaric, but it is not as barbaric as it may seem, because in the culture in which they lived at that time, burning alive was a common form of punishment for whatever they did. As a matter of fact, in that part of the world, there it was so much oil on the surface of the ground and oozing up out of the ground that it was used to power these furnaces. They used it as a medicine. They would take it internally because it was supposedly able to cure things like stomach issues. They would rub it on their joints because of rheumatism. And so oil has been with us for a long time and has been the source of trouble since the beginning. And so here he has these people and he gives them this ultimatum. In Jeremiah 29, we have an account of two men who were burned by Nebuchadnezzar. So this is no idle threat. And if you'll recall, just a very few months ago, a terrorist group from this area of the world, from this part of the world, burned to death a Jordanian pilot and several other people in a cage because of who they were. And as barbaric as it seemed at the time, they broadcast it on television for all the world to see. But if you think about our own country, over 300 years ago, we regularly burned people because we thought they were witches or subversive in some way. So this concept of burning is not particular or unique to the Middle East, but it's a concept and a way of punishment that was reserved for the most violent criminal, the most violent person, or the most odd person among us, because we wanted to make people fear what might happen. You see, this whole concept of burning for crimes was written into the Babylonian code. It was called Hammurabi's code. It was written over 1,000 years before Nebuchadnezzar by an early king. And so this whole idea of burning was a real possibility. But notice in verse 7 that something happens here when this sound of music occurs. Everyone in the kingdom bows their knee. You see, when you don't stand for anything, you'll bow to anything. People have said oftentimes that if you don't have a faith that's grounded, you will bow to anything. And you find these people, they didn't have a problem bowing to this image because they bowed to multiple gods. And so one more god was not a big deal. They didn't have a problem with that. If you go over to India today, they have something over 1 million gods that they bow to in India. All of these different gods. And they don't have a problem with a new god. And one of the problems with Christianity in particular when it was came on the scene was the fact that it did not recognize any of the rest of these gods. You see, if it had recognized all of the rest of the gods and it was just another god in addition to the ones they already had, no one would have cared. But the fact that it stood up and said there's only one God, that's when it became a problem. And you see, that's what happens to us. Listen to me. If you look at the leaders of our country and you say to them, fine, you know, your ideas are as good as mine, multiculturalism, then everything's good. And we have many people in the church today in many denominations, that's what they do. They look at the government, they look at each other, and they say, fine, not a problem. It's in violation with the Bible, but, you know, it's relative. It's up to your interpretation. But you see, true Christians don't do that. They stand up while everyone else is bowing down. And that's why we are a problem. I shared with you a few years ago the poet from Louisiana, the Russian poet who lives down there. His name escapes me, but he's on public radio, who said he would be very happy if something happened and all Christians just disappeared. And wouldn't that just be great? Because you see, we're a sore spot. We're the fly in the ointment. We're the splinter under the fingernail. We're the irritation. You remember what Haman said about Mordecai? He said, I cannot get any peace because I look at him every time I walk past him and he does not bow to me. And so he's a sore spot for me and I must get rid of him. And you see, that's the way the world looks at us. They look at us naturally because there's something down deep in their heart that tells them that we are a threat to them. And that's why they look at us the way they do. That's why they react to us the way they react, because of sin. Look again at verses 8 through 12 and notice the accusation that they bring. If you think about the background of these men, the first thing that you have to understand is that these men are in competition with these three Jews. You see, remember, in 20 years earlier, these three Jews had been promoted over all of these men after the interpretation of the dream. These boys were about 19 years old when they were promoted over men 20, 30, 40 years their senior. There's a sore spot there. Think about when you're at work and when you're in a job that you're in and somebody's promoted over you who's much younger than you are. You know, one of the major problems in this country is when older people have to train younger workers to take their place because the younger worker is paid less than the older worker. It's a sore spot, isn't it, when you see that happen? So these guys have a sore spot. They've got a grudge. They've been harboring this grudge for 20 years. And if you've ever worked in a company where people struggle with jealousy, you can kind of appreciate what was going on here, the dynamic that was beginning to occur. And nothing breeds an environment like that. Like a environment of despotism. Look at verse 12 in particular, and I want you to notice the three-prong attack that they use. The first that they do is they know that there's something about Nebuchadnezzar, and that is that he wants respect. Nebuchadnezzar wants to be respected. So they come up to him and they say to him, they've shown you disrespect. They've ignored you. They don't respect you. So they begin their attack. Listen to what they do. They look at him and they say to him, "You want to be respected. These guys do not respect you." It's an attack on his governorship. It's an attack on his kingship. And the second one they use is they say, they're nonconformist. They're not multicultural. They don't agree with everyone else. They're different. And if you've ever been in a situation where you've stuck out, have you ever gone to a party where you weren't dressed right? You ever done that? You know the feeling? You know what I'm talking about? I remember going to a recital a few years ago. I don't know what I was thinking, but I wore a plaid shirt and plaid shorts. I don't know what I must not have. Kathy obviously was not looking at me while I was, you know, being dressed at the time. She had lost that aura that I was the greatest thing, so she'd given up on me. And so here I go to this thing, and Mark Heinrich looks at me and he says, "Oh, I see you wore plaid today." And so I matched. That was my concern, but it was just not the right combination of matching. So they're looking at them and they're saying, "You're nonconformist. They're nonconformists. They're divisive. And they don't serve your gods." So they hit him where it hurts. Because they're looking at him and they're saying, if you want unity, and remember, that's the purpose of this little gathering today is unity. Remember, that's why you did this whole thing. I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't some of the driving force to kind of get it to happen. Because they probably knew that these guys wouldn't bow. And if they could get something like this to happen, that would be the fastest way, the cleanest way, the neatest way, without being accused themselves of getting rid of these guys. And the last reason is they look at him and they say they're rebels. They won't take the pledge. They won't worship your image. And so here we have with disrespectful, nonconformers, and rebellers. They are rebels with a cause. And if you think about what he happens there, look at what happens to him as soon as he hears this. He looks at them and he falls into a rage because what they have told him in essence is these men are un-Babylonian. These men are a threat. And if you remember just a very few years ago, there was a period of time called the Cold War where we were fighting with Russia, but we weren't fighting with Russia. And during that period of time, everyone was scared to death that the communists were going to come in, infiltrate our country, and take us over. I can remember my mom, who had survived the Nazi era and the moving in of the Russians as they came into Germany, and she would tell me, "You must be useful, because when the Russians take us over, you don't want to be sent to a camp. And so you must learn as many trades as possible to be prepared because they will at some point take us over." And for those of you who remember the leader of Russia at the time at the United Nations taking his shoe off and beating the podium and saying, "We will destroy you." And there was that fear that that was literally going to happen. They were going to drop a bomb on us and it would all be over and then we would all become Russians and become communists. Well, this hysteria that was occurring at that time was very similar to what was happening here with Nebuchadnezzar, and it was a particular breeding ground for a junior senator from Wisconsin named what? Joseph McCarthy. And McCarthy found a cause in this anti-communist sentiment, and he believed that if he fanned that fear, that would make him popular in his district, and it would help with his reelection. And so he formed something that became known as the Un-American Committee to sniff out anyone who was suspected of being a communist sympathizer. And one of his favorite targets at the time, and a favorite target of all people who were against any hint of disunion, was the movie industry. And before he was finished, many prominent actors, actresses, and screenwriters had been blackballed, and their careers were ruined. One of the movies in particular that he and others questioned was a movie that most of us have seen, and we usually watch it every Christmas, called It's a Wonderful Life. And that was one of the ones that they questioned. They said, it is un-American because it questions the validity of bankers and those who have money. And so it's infiltrated by communism. It's obviously un-American. And so what we find here is this un-Babylonian committee, this group, These are the people who have set themselves up to sniff out any subversion, any hint of disunion, and they are sniffing these men out. But look at his violent reaction. Look at verses 13 through 15, and we'll wrap this thing up. Notice in 13 the reaction the king makes to this news. He becomes violently angry. And you can almost imagine him foaming at the mouth and stomping his feet and saying, "I will have my way. These men will obey. Just bring them to me and show me who they are, and I can guarantee you they will bow the knee to me." Back several years ago during World War II, Adolf Hitler would often fly into similar rages. Sometimes his rages would last for hours. Can you imagine it? Hours. Where he would scream at the people who were in the meeting with him and foam at the mouth. The veins on his temples would burst almost with the frustration that he felt and the rage that he would vent toward those who were around him. And that's the picture of what the Bible is painting for us here. Here's Nebuchadnezzar in a violent rage, foaming at the mouth, red in the face. Remember what it says? It says later on, it's his whole visage changed. His whole face changed. You ever been around somebody that mad? It's a scary thing, isn't it? To be in the presence of somebody who is that angry. And so here these men are brought before him. And look at what happens here. Verses 14 and 15 show a change. Something happens to him. He has a few moments to calm down. And then he realizes who he's accusing. You see, these Chaldeans didn't tell him who they were accusing. And he looks at them and he realizes they are the friends of his trusted advisor, Daniel. And so as he looks at them, he begins to calm down. And he looks at them and he says to them with incredulity in his voice, he says, "Is it true?" He looks at them and he says, "You have got to be joking. Surely you're pulling my leg. This can't be true. This just is a misunderstanding. Obviously, you didn't hear well. You're getting older, too, and so your ears aren't working." And so he looks at them and he says, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you another chance. I'll let you have one more chance. If you hear these instruments playing, bow down, and it'll all be forgotten. It's just a mistake. Misunderstanding." But look at what happens. He also gives them a warning. He says, "If you don't, I will make sure that you're burned to a crisp. And who is the God who will do what? Who will deliver you from me?" And if you think about that statement in light of what had occurred 20 years before, where he had declared that Daniel's God was the God of gods and the Lord of kings, it's amazing that he had totally forgotten that. And you see, people go through a church service like this every single Sunday, where they hear something like this, and they hear it, and they hear it, and they hear it, and they hear it, and they go straight out that door, and it doesn't go any farther than in here and back out the other side. And you see, that's the same thing that happened with Nebuchadnezzar. He saw it. He saw this dream that no one else could interpret. He saw it happen. He heard it happen. And yet it went one ear and out the other. It didn't stay. And so there's a warning here that we need to pay attention to the truth. As the Bible tells us, in the day of salvation, if you hear his voice, don't harden your heart. Don't turn from him, but turn to him, and don't harden your heart. Because the day will come when he will no longer move your heart to turn to him. And none of us knows when that day will come. Look again at verse 16 through 18. And I want you to notice in particular how these Jews answer him. They look at him and they say, "We don't need to think about it. We don't need to talk to each other. We don't need to discuss this. We're firm in our determination to do what's right." Nebuchadnezzar, you're giving us an opportunity to go talk, but we don't need to talk. We know what our answer is right now. And they respond with a twofold confession. Listen to it. "If the God we serve exists, he can and will do what? Rescue us." But then they look at him with a caveat and they say, "But if he chooses not to do it, if he looks at us and he says, no, we still will not serve your gods." An amazing confession. In his book, Agents of Babylon, David Jeremiah quotes H.C. Leopold's comments on these men's profession of faith. And this is what he says. Listen to it here, and we're almost finished. The quiet, modest, yet positive attitude of faith that these men display is one of the noblest examples in the scriptures of faith fully resigned to the will of God. These men ask for no miracle. They expect none. Theirs is the faith that says, though he slay me, yet will I do what? I will trust him. You see, without being rude, without being obnoxious, without being disrespectful, these men simply looked at the world's most powerful king and said, our minds are made up. There's nothing that you can do that will convince us otherwise. And they're looking at him and they're really saying, let the party begin. Martin Luther once said this. He said, Jesus Christ lived in the midst of his enemies. On the cross, he was utterly alone, surrounded by evildoers and mockers. For this cause, he had come to bring peace to the enemies of God so that the Christian, too, belongs not in the seclusion of a cloistered life, but in the thick of foes. There is his commission, his work. You see, like the 40 soldiers on the ice, these men were determined to die for what they believed. They weren't going to give up. You see, almost every day we hear some person who's being ridiculed for their faith or fired, thrown in jail, their business taken from them, the government's going after them. And I don't like to spend my time worrying about those things. I don't spend my time fretting and wondering when the day will come for me. Because you see, in the position that I am as principal of a public school, one day it will most likely happen to me. I will have to make a choice. Kathy and I were talking about it last night. What will I do when that moment comes? How will I stand? But you see, I try to keep my attention focused on the one who's able to bring us through whatever lies ahead. You see, whatever happens, what position we're in, where we are, God will provide a way. What did he say? I will give you what? The words to say at that moment. Don't worry about what you're going to say. Don't worry about what you're going to do. Stand faithful to Christ and he'll show you. You see, none of us knows whether we're going to have to take a stand like these men. But what I pray for, now listen to me, and this is what we need to pray for. I pray that God will help us to have the courage and determination that these men showed. You see, that's the important thing. It's not how loud you clap in here. It's not how loud you sing in here. It's not how often or how much of this you read. But it's how you react in that still small moment when that little word is said to you. Are you a what? A Christian. That is what's important. And that's when he looks at you and he says to you, are you mine, or are you going to turn your back, crawl off the ice, and give up? Let's all stand. Our Father, we come before you to present every person here to you. Examine our hearts, examine our lives, examine us as we go through this day, as we go through the coming days, through this week. Help us to see those moments when we teeter, when we're tempted to deny you. Help us to have the courage of that man who said, I too am a Christian. Help us to go walk out on that ice, strip off all of our pretension. Bow low to you and give of ourselves in sacrifice to you, Father. Give us that courage. Honor your word. Honor this opportunity that we've had to be here together with you. In Jesus' name, amen.